So the thing is, even though I'm sitting here, I think I'm going to refer most of the questions to you. So this is just giving him a break from sitting here. So for a moment, let's bring our mind back to our motivation. I think that we're trying to realize this ultimate nature in order to free ourselves and others from cyclic existence and to attain full awakening, where we'll have all the wisdom, skill, and compassion necessary to be of the greatest benefit. Okay. Oh, okay. So, questions? Huh?
I didn't turn the mic on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is actually one for Guy, but I'll ask you.
Okay.
I was going to ask Guy how it was that he took these teachings and this from an academic point of view and translated into his life. But not, I know you're trans, but my real question is... For me, this what feel like are subtle distinctions, and my mind doesn't have that quite academic mind, or at least that's the way that I've limited that. Feels like the energy and the effort to make those fine distinctions feel like I have plenty to work with without knowing more of the what feels a bit esoteric about the distinctions between even the different schools. And so I lose a little bit of what feels like the practical application of some of the distinctions.
Okay. So I'm not sure I completely understand. You're saying making such subtle distinctions doesn't necessarily seem so relevant to you
in terms of practice. Translate that into what's meaningful or practical or what would make a difference in terms of my having a better understanding. And maybe some of it is just a mental block or not feeling like I have that precision for it. And so especially when I listen to others and their capacity for that, like in the way, way lower capacity. And so sometimes feel quite lost, and I know, yes, those are great imprints, but sometimes I lose energy about that in terms of going, why am I listening for those subtle distinctions where I have a lot of these real gross things that I haven't gotten
yet? Oh, okay, yeah. So why am I learning all these subtle, fine points of philosophy when my mind is, like, so gross and...
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, the thing is, I think, is to practice where you're at, but you learn the future steps so that when you've kind of completed the practice of where you're at, then you already have the knowledge for how to practice at a deeper level. You see what I mean? So it's like, you may be taking a cooking class and you're learning how to boil eggs, but you can still read books about, you know, how to make ice cream or then chocolate cake, even though you're not at that level yet. And it seems so detailed and complicated. But the thing is, you know, you're learning it, so you're getting some idea of where to go. And when you've mastered boiled eggs, you won't have to start over at the beginning, you know, with, well, what do I do now? Because you'll already, at least intellectually, have some kind of idea about where to go. Yeah? That makes some sense to you? Yeah? And because the thing is, as you think about these things more, I mean, it's true at the beginning, it's like, why are they making all this picky stuff? But as you think about it more, then some of these questions naturally appear to your mind. And then if you've done that study, then you go, oh, that's why they were talking about that. Yeah. But many of these things, it's like in my experiences, I don't understand until way later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then kind of the light bulb goes on and you see why it's important. Yeah.
I keep being confused about the issue of whether Buddha's, is it no conventional truth? We've talked about that.
Yeah.
And because I thought, or conventional reality, whatever, that it's really only all made up of imputations mm-hmm. by each of us imputing, all beings imputing. Mm-hmm. And so what would there be for a Buddha to know? In a way, I know I'm coming from a...
Oh, you're like the ones we were talking about who say conventionalities are only for confused people. and Buddhas only know ultimate truth.
Well, on the one hand, Buddhas can help us, so obviously they have some access to something. So I guess the question is what or how. But more coming from the perspective of what would a Buddha know in terms of, if conventional reality is just all an imputation, it uh-huh. doesn't really exist from the perspective...
Wait, okay, that's where you need to start. Okay. When you say it's just imputation, so it doesn't really exist, okay? So it's imputation, so it doesn't truly exist. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Okay, right, right.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So conventional reality does exist, not truly, only conventionally. And the Buddha can perceive it.
So the way it exists conventionally is...
Dependent.
Dependent on minds.
Right.
Beings.
Right.
So a Buddha would have to... So it's like, how could a Buddha know conventional reality in some way separate from the minds that are, in a sense...
Okay. Well, in one way, he knows conventional reality as seen by sentient beings, and that's where we say that the Buddha can, you know, see true existence because he sees what we see, which is true existence.
Through our eyes.
Yeah, yeah. But like what Guy was saying, when we talk of, like, you know, the ten qualities of a Buddha or the four fearlessnesses or things like that, those are things that are pure phenomena that only a Buddha apprehends directly. They're imputed by the lower level bodhisattvas who still have conceptual mind. Yeah, they conventionally exist, but the Buddha, you know, they only are known directly by a Buddha's mind, and so a Buddha would see them as, you know, sees them as empty and also dependent. I mean, that's the only way I can make sense out of it, is that the Buddha, you know, sees them on a conventional level as dependently arising. Now, what that would look like, I have no idea.
Okay, I think I was forgetting about the fact that there's a pure version of conventional reality.
Yeah.
And just thinking of the impure.
Okay, but even our impure version, you know, when the Buddha looks at it, you know, he may see the true existence because we see it, but when he looks at the table, he's not going to see the table as truly existent. So he'd see the table, or she'd see the table as a dependent arising.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And it probably would look very different than the way the table looks to us.
Yeah.
Wouldn't
yeah.
he see the causes and conditions? I mean, wouldn't the Buddha just see all of the energy, the causes and conditions
yeah.
that made that come, not the table itself?
Well, the Buddha would see all of it.
And the table, because yes. we see the table as a table.
And also because the table's there.
Well, that's what I was getting at.
I mean, the table exists. It doesn't truly exist, doesn't ultimately exist, but it exists. So the Buddha's omniscient. He's got to know the table.
Okay, I might be slipping into like maybe Chittamatra, where I was thinking the only table that exists is the one that's in your mind, your mind, your mind, your mind, your mind, my mind.
Yeah, now it's true that there's no objective table out there independent from all of our minds. That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. But you can't say that the only table that exists is, you know, what appears to each of our minds. Because they say there are external objects. You just can't find them when you look for them.
Yeah.
With ultimate analysis. And that's hard, you know.
Yeah,
there's external objects, but when you look for them with analysis, you find that they aren't there. Then why do you call them external objects?
Yeah, exactly.
Because what we think external means objectively existent. Mm-hmm. Because from our perspective, if it's external, it seems objectively existent. But that's not the meaning. Yeah?
Or would it be the meaning like...
Something that's not conjoined with consciousness.
Okay, so like would you use the word aggregate for that even? Or would you all five aggregates, but like the
final aggregate? Or you would say the floor, for example. Yeah. Or you could say, you know, the body. Say that too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of it comes back to this thing that as soon as we say existent, we think truly existent. And as soon as we say empty, we think totally non-existent. Yeah? I mean, that kind of thing comes again and again. Yeah?
I might have trouble formulating the question, but it seems like the way it's taught is that the foundation of traversing the path to Buddhahood is reliance on this spiritual mentor.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like when we get into analysis and Madhyamaka philosophy and how to actually analyze to understand ultimate reality, talk of a spiritual mentor isn't really there. And then it comes back in Tantra, which is like really the highest view.
Okay.
So like where does reliance on the spiritual mentor come in with analyzing?
Okay. Okay, so we hear at the beginning, reliance on the spiritual master is the root of the path. When we get to the chapter on emptiness, we don't really hear much about the spiritual master. And then when we come back to Tantra, it's like, you know, the gurus, the Buddha, and you know, like that. Just because when we're talking about emptiness, it doesn't talk about the spiritual master doesn't mean that it's not important. It was taught earlier in the path. Because who's going to explain the correct view to you? Yeah? How are you going to learn the correct view? And I'll just pick up a book and read it. Well, are we going to get the right view by, you know, can we pick up Chandrakirti and understand him correctly? Even, you know, can we pick up Jay Rinpoche and understand him correctly? Yeah. So, you know, when we look, we really need help in understanding what these great sages are saying. And so who is it who helps us? It's the spiritual mentor. Yeah. And so because that person is teaching us the view that if we're able to correctly realize it will enable us to be free of cyclic existence, then, you know, automatically the respect and appreciation comes. Because how else am I going to learn this? Do you get what I mean? Yeah?
And why is it, like in some systems, taught that, you know, you can proceed solely on devotion to the spiritual mentor without, you know, focusing that much on this kind of...
Oh, okay. So why do some people teach you that you progress solely by devotion to a spiritual master and not through study? I don't think there's too many systems that teach that. Because if you look, I mean, even in Tantra, you know, the guru is very important, but to do Tantra you have to study, and you have to have that based on all the sutra teachings that you've learned through study. So it's not just this thing of, you know, oh, well, somebody said the guru is Buddha, so ali ali salami, I believe that and I worship, and through that I'm going to get enlightened. Because you know, that kind of attitude doesn't remove our self-grasping, doesn't remove our self-centeredness. Sometimes it even increases our nam-tok. Yeah? So it's important to understand what this all means in the correct way. Yeah? So, and that's why I don't like the expression guru devotion, because we think of devotion as just this blind worship. And similarly, you know, translating it as guru worship, you know, the guru puja's guru worship, I don't like that translation either. Because we just have this, or at least I have the connotation of worship as like it's just, yeah, ali ali salami with no understanding. And we're not going to get anywhere on the path that way. You know, we've done that many, many lifetimes in the past. And we're still here. Okay, so it's not a process of just blind devotion and stuff like that. It's, you know, when we appreciate the teachings, then we appreciate the role of the spiritual mentor, because that person opened the door to the teachings for us, because we couldn't understand the teachings by ourselves. But it doesn't mean that just blindly worshiping the person of the spiritual mentor is going to help us understand the teachings. It's, you know, using our own wisdom and developing the ability to think and investigate and analyze that's going to develop that understanding. But also, at the same time, if we just approach emptiness in a basically kind of intellectual way, you know, analysis, intellectual person, you know, I'm just going to analyze to death because I have a high IQ and I'm going to get it. That doesn't work either, because the kind of wisdom and intelligence we need in Buddhism is different than the IQ measurement they do in secular topics. And somebody can have, that, you know, no rocket science, and when it comes to Buddhism, they can't even get the fact that lying is a negative action. You know, so it's a different kind of intelligence and wisdom that we're developing. And to develop the kind of Dharma wisdom and intelligence that we need, having an attitude of respect for our teacher and accumulating merit and doing purification and all these kinds of practices are very, very good for softening the mind and opening the mind so that when we hear the teachings, we can understand them. That's why Manjushri sent Jay Rinpoche to do retreat. Yeah, and he did 3.5 million prostrations, 100,000 prostrations to each of the 35 Buddhists, and he did gazillions of mandala offerings and all sorts of guru yoga practices, because those are the things that purified and created merit and made the mind receptive so that then he could actually understand the teachings. Yeah. So I think we have to approach the path with this combination of, you know, both using intelligence and wisdom and having an attitude of faith and confidence and respect and appreciation that all are developed on the basis of understanding the teachings and that are not blind. Okay? Make sense?
Yeah.
No more questions. Good. Guy, what did you think of my answers? Feel free to correct.
Yeah, no, it's really helpful. In terms of Kevin's question, I don't really... it's very hard for me to say whether help studying all this has helped me personally or not, frankly. And I don't think it's hurt me. and it's certainly been interesting, and I think And it's, I think I could say, I mean, here's the thing. Last time when I talked about the two truths, I said, well, and, you know, we argued about whether this was a right statement or not, but I said, it's not really like a basic practice. You know, there isn't the meditation on the two truths per se. It's this whole way of thinking about how does emptiness relate to conventional reality is, it's sort of like, how can we do the practices that are necessary without having one damage the other? And so it's like thinking about these things is, I guess it's an aspect of practice in that it's like a way of keeping your understanding of reality damaged the idea that there are these distinctions between lying and not lying, or becoming, you know, so attached to the way things appear at the conventional level that you can't understand emptiness. And so, I have very limited ability to say about how this has benefited me personally, but I can say more about like what attracts me to it is that I find it a very coherent way of making sense of the world and resolving the tension that I feel between my sense and conviction that there really isn't anything graspable, and on the other hand, needing to not have that contradict ethics or common sense. And it's like, but then how do you explain that? And it seems to me that Tsongkhapa did better at doing that than other people. And so that's why I guess I find it useful, because it's like, I think it is a big part of the way I think about the world just comes from the way he solved the problem. And I mean, it's related to this question about like, just if there's nothing that we can do because everything is just an illusion, and then there's God or Buddha who knows the truth on the other side, and we wait for a light to come down or something like that, then this is another way of looking at the world religiously that seems actually a lot more popular. I mean, not just outside of Buddhism, but even within Buddhism. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work for me. So then, okay, so, you know, but then I feel a spiritual inclination, but no ability to have any faith in some, you know, kind of essentially real absolute power that's behind it all. And so then what's left is a kind of thing like this that seems to solve a lot of problems for me.
I do have a question, if we can. Mostly, I just want to ask for some elaboration on this quote. Therefore, dependently arisen phenomena carry out functions only from their perspective of means and terms. So it's the functionality question that I kind of always get hung up in. If we conceive of a phenomena and it performs a certain function, somehow I feel like the function is inside that phenomena, that must be the thing that exists. Mm-hmm. So actually understanding where functionality falls into this name and term mm-hmm. thing, which I don't really get anyway, but mm-hmm. I play with, where does that fit?
Okay. So where does functionality fit within things existing by mere name? Okay, so when we say mere name, it doesn't mean that there's just names. Yeah, it means that things exist in relationship to the mind. Okay, and functionality, you said, you know, it seems like, okay, if something performs that function is inside of it, and so therefore it has some inherent nature. Okay, well, that's what it looks like from our viewpoint, that this cup, you know, has the function of holding water from its own side. But if you ask an ant, yeah, first of all, the ant doesn't call it a cup, and it wouldn't see it as having that function. Okay? So it only has that function in relationship to us who have the karma to see it that way. Also, it only has that function in relationship to water, in relationship to the table, in relationship to the clay, in relationship to plates. You know, things don't have a function in and of themselves because they only function in relationship to things that aren't them. Okay? So it's this whole thing of relational dependence that His Holiness talks about. How long and short are dependent on each other. But it's what I was saying the other night, that anything that we talk about exists within an environment, and its identity depends on that entire environment. It isn't something that has some characteristics and identity in and of itself, separate from its environment.
So here's where I get into trouble. I'm sure I'm making it very solid, but you know, in the exercise of trying to look at a cup, mm-hmm. and identify what's the basis of designation of this label cup, mm-hmm. then I've got one cup, one lid, one bottom, one thing, one there. The function doesn't really go into that basis.
Yeah, but, right.
But
yeah, the function isn't there in the lid, in the sides, in the bottom of the cup. The function
right.
isn't there,
it's
is it?
Totally in my concept.
Yeah. Well, the function, you label it cup, but the function exists in relationship to everything else. Right. If there weren't water, the function of the cup couldn't be to hold it.
Right. So the basis of designation is separate from looking at that other kind of. I mean, is a different way of viewing it than stepping back and looking at it and its relational dependence to other things. Is that right?
Well, we're trying to look at something from many, many different viewpoints. And one is, if you think the function is in the object, is to analyze the parts and see if any of the parts has that function. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to say, well, why do I think it has this function at all? On what basis do I say that the cup has the function to hold water? Well, on the basis of there being water, on the basis of there being gravity, because, you know, the cup has to go up and the water goes down, and on the basis of there being a table that you put the cup on, because if there were no planet or table, you know, you wouldn't have a cup that has water. And, you know, there's this whole environmental thing that's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and then on what basis does it function to hold water? Also because I'm a human being.
Okay,
yeah.
That's very helpful.
And the karma through which I have to look at it. You know, I look at this and, you know, these are very meaningful. Yeah, they function very well when I try and see things. If you ask, you know, Maitri the cat, these are useless. You know, the only function they are is to clutter the table when you're trying to get to the cheese. Yeah. Yeah, or their only function is to, knock off the table when you're bored. Okay. So you can see, I mean, they don't have an inherent function inside of them. Yeah?
So that relates to what is a valid cognizer, too. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to mean that every cognizer has to agree on an
right.
object.
Yeah, it doesn't mean every sentient being in the universe agrees on what this thing is and what to call it and how it functions. Yeah, that's why sometimes I think valid cognizer, the word valid for me appears a little bit truly existent. You know, it's a valid cognizer. From its own side, it's valid. And I like the translation reliable cognizer better because it's reliable in the sense that you know what you can do with this thing. Yeah, it doesn't mean that it has some inherent valid nature, but it's just reliable because you know what you can do with it.
So okay. Like a Prana doesn't need to validate the
what?
like a pretta doesn't need to validate that object.
No, because a pretta, you know, this wouldn't appear as a glass of water, a cup of water. It would appear as a cup of, you know, pus and blood. So valid is according to, you know, a group of sentient beings who have particular karma to see things in a particular way. From the pretta's view, they would see pus and blood, and that's a valid cognizer from the viewpoint of a pretta. And when a god sees, you know, celestial, you know, bliss, nectar in it, that's a valid cognizer from the viewpoint of that celestial being. Okay? So there can be many valid cognizers of a single base. That's why it's more better to say reliable cognizer.
I've gone to using that.
Yeah.
The new translation, Yola, epistemic instruments.
Yeah, I've read that and I said, no. That it's an instrument. It's like, you know, like a violin or something.
Instrument means instrumentality, a means of knowing, and epistemic means the knowing part. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's the current fashion among the philosophical.
It almost sounds like you're creating a language just to keep us common folk to not understand.
You can say, you know, reliable knower, reliable source of knowledge, reliable cognition. I think those are all better than valid. It turns out that valid has a technical meaning in Western logic that doesn't really correspond to what we're trying to say anyway.
The technical meaning of valid doesn't correspond to the phrase valid cognizer?
That's my understanding, right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to do with a certain qualities of a proof, and it's not really to do with what we're trying to say, is that this is an authoritative, something, you know, a source of information that you can count on, is all we're really trying to say.
Yeah.
I like that. Source of information. I think the really nice thing, Lee and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, you know, and I was like going, okay, so we wind around, you know, we start off with Arjuna, who posits himself the problem of attachment, and then how do you break that attachment, and then he gets into the emptiness with that worked for him, and then you go down several centuries later and come around to Tsongkhapa, and he starts talking about functionality, you know, things function, and then where my mind goes is, okay, well, I'm a functioning being in a functioning world, and so how does this help me, you know, in my aspirations to get rid of my attachments? But listening to what you were just saying now about, you know, about the context, you know, the interdependent context, that is really helpful, because that promotes, to me, that promotes ethics. If you see things as individual and self-sufficient and that's over there and I'm over here, then you really don't have a basis in that, really a real basis in that for ethical behavior. But if you see everything as being interdependent, you know, and then you start getting into the Shantideva world of, you know, why do I call this my foot?
So I like that. I think, you know, it's good. Yeah. Good. Anything else?
I don't think I quite understood the explanation and the meaning, really, of the, when you were explaining the second verse in the Arjuna,
The one about going.
Yeah, the one about the tricycle.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of, it's like one of those math puzzles, you know, you get in seventh grade or something. So, like, if you're, it's like we say, I'm going. Okay. Now, what do we really mean? Where does the, by I'm going? And where does the going take place? Okay. So, if this is my foot and I lift it up, you know, where is the going? If I start out here on this side of the line and I'm is going there, where is the going actually taken place? Because half of my foot hasn't gone. Half of my foot has already gone. So where is the point where my foot is actually going?
It's like, where's the prostration in the prostration?
Yeah.
Which part?
Yeah.
And that was more of like a where, like a location-related one.
Yeah. Yeah. But, it you know, it's quite an interesting thing when you're walking and you say, I'm going. Where actually is the going happening? Because we go, we all get somewhere. But where is the going happening? And is the going happening in the past, in the present, in the future? Yeah, because if it happens in the past, then it's the have gone. If it happens in the future, it's the will go. In the present, where are you going to identify the going?
And how long is your present?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the present is the only thing we have that we live in. But how do we identify it? Because our minds want to, you know, make a square around it and then freeze it so it doesn't change into the past. But just already by talking about it, it's already gone.
In Tai Chi, we have a thing about, you know, when you shift your weight, that's when you are taking a step. Because it's all this stuff about shifting your body and taking the weight off the back of this foot, mm-hmm. while this foot's not yet fully on the ground, and when this foot hits the ground. So when you release the mm-hmm. other foot, but you no longer have your weight on that one, I mean, this is one of the same things.
It's it's the same thing. Is it, you know, have it, it, or it's like saying, when does an hour happen? Okay, an hour is made of 60 minutes. Well, what is, when does the hour exist? Yeah, at the end of the 60th minute? Does the hour exist at the end of the 60th minute? No, because then the hour is already over. Isn't it? Yeah. Does it begin exist at the first moment of the first minute? It hasn't started. Does it exist midway between the 30th minute? No. Yeah. So when do we have an hour?
3.5.
I mean, what really is an hour?
So we start unpacking these things with analysis and start seeing that we really, life is an incredible mystery. So the quote that I heard recently, they're saying, you know, we know in science things in extremes, like extremely big things like universes and extremely small things like atoms, but what we don't know is what happens to the cream when it goes into the cup of coffee. That our mundane reality is full of these mysteries that completely unexplored.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that we're trying to make everything into nice little packets with lines about them, around them. And none of these packets depend on any of the other packets. And we're trying to do that, and it doesn't work because things don't exist that way. Yeah. And, you know, in the same way, I mean, just on a practical level, I find it always fascinating to say, you know, because the word my comes up so much. Yeah. What is mine about this? You know? My reputation. What is mine about a reputation? What is a reputation? Yeah. Yeah. My what? My pen. What is mine about this pen? And yet giving it the word mine makes a huge difference between not giving it the word mine. But what is mine about this pen? And we say, my friends, what is mine about that other person? What is mine? Yeah. So, you know, all these kinds of things, when you really start questioning them, I think that they loosen up our mind that wants to hold on to everything so tightly. Yeah. It actually provides a lot of space. You know, there's nothing mine inside my relatives. There's nothing mine inside my possessions. In fact, there's nothing mine inside my body. And there's nothing mine inside of my ideas. Oh my goodness. And there's nothing mine inside of my emotions. Yeah? So, you know, if you think about that, then whoa, there's just a lot, it's a lot easier in life, I think. Whereas, you know, when everything is, you know, as soon as we give the word my or mine to something, you know, this whole ton of meaning gets imputed on it that it doesn't have from its own side. And that way of living is so difficult. Yeah?
Yeah, as you talk, it just seems like we screwed it all up by creating language. It feels like all these obscurations are created because we need a way to talk about the book that happens to be in my possession more than it's in yours.
Yeah.
Or you know, and as soon as we put a label to it, as soon as we put a word to it, it seems like it's we've completely lost it.
The problem isn't our giving words to it. The problem is forgetting that we were the ones who gave the words. Yeah? If we always remembered that we were the ones who labeled and conceived something, they wouldn't be problems. But we forget, and instead we think that they have a nature out there independent from us. That's what gives the problem.
It's like a diagnosis.
What do you mean?
I'm constantly having that conversation with people who have been diagnosed with mental illness, because they hear depression and they reify it. This means...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, mental diagnosis sometimes makes things so much worse. And especially, have you noticed now, every child has a disorder. If you don't have a disorder, you're not like everybody else. But when you have a disorder, then there's something wrong with you. So now you have original sin plus a disorder. I mean, we're really making it hard for kids. Original sin wasn't bad enough. Yeah. But everybody, you know, you're not a kid who is exuberant and hasn't learned rules. You have an obstinate, defiant disorder or something, whatever they call it. You know? And it's like, oh my goodness, as soon as the kid gets that designation, it's like, well, then I'm hopeless. I'm totally hopeless. I have this designation, or this disease, this disorder.
But that's what we do anyway. I mean, we do this ourselves. To me, you know, I think it's the miracle of, you know, the purification practices is to remind myself that I, you know, that I'm not any particular way. You know, I'm not, because if I have these memories of being an angry, obstinate person, and I say, oh, I am an angry, obstinate person, then I can't change from being an angry, obstinate person to a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of the purification practice is to try to break through that. Same thing. Exactly. It's a diagnosis. It may not have a Latin name to it, but it's still a diagnosis. How do I change? Well, I'm changing all the time anyway. So.
Yeah. So if I'm going to make a little bit more additional commentary about modern society, you know, in addition to original sin, in addition to a disorder, if we say that this is all caused by genes, then forget it. Then we really can't change. You know, if my anger is caused by my genes, if my alcoholism is caused by my genes, if whatever problem I have, you know, is caused by my genes, then I can't change at all. And, you know, and I think that's really, really dangerous. And people give up personal responsibility.
And it's also not scientifically accurate, because your genes are changed by you.
Yeah. So we have to stop now. And at 7 o'clock we'll have the, you know, the bi-monthly confession. Did somebody explain that to all of you, what we do? Okay, so we will be doing some bowing to the Buddha with the Chinese chanting, and then we'll take the Three Refuges, which is also a way of dedicating and motivating. And then we'll do the confession verse from the King of Prayers, and we chant it very slowly, and then that way we can really think of the things that we've regret that we want to purify. And it's very helpful as you're chanting it slowly, and you say each word, you know, every action I have done, you know, you look at each word and think that word, you know, it's only a word. You know, that it's a concept, it's a word that's made up about something, that there aren't any harmful actions that are objectively existent out there. But what is harmful is labeled in relationship to the kind of results it brings, and in relationship to what the actions that bring good results as well. And so as you know, this is how you bring this kind of analysis into what you're doing. And so are you saying the prayer, you know? Every action I've done by my body, speech, and mind. Well, think about how body, speech, and mind are all empty of true existence, and yet they exist. You know, and overwhelmed by attachment, anger, and confusion. How those are just labels given to certain mental states that have some common qualities but are not exactly the same. Yeah? And so in that way you kind of bring an understanding of dependent arising and emptiness to the practice of purifying our mistaken actions. Yeah? And then after we do all the chanting together, and then the lay people, well, maybe this time the lay people will stay in here, and Jonathan and Kathleen will lead you in the refuge, renewing refuge and precept. And then the Sangha, we do our confession, we'll go in the library. Okay? So we'll start all that in 42 minutes. Okay? Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. Just one more thing. Did in the introduction yesterday, did you explain about the inmate articles?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So please feel free to read those. And whoa.